Good afternoon and welcome to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. Real Talk is the show that seeks answers to questions, large and small. We try to bring people and questions together here on Real Talk for you every Tuesday at noon. So thanks for joining us for lunch. If you've got some ideas, if you've got some big questions, large or small, send them to me at realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. Today, the question is, what is the personal impact of immigration and refugee status, and how does it affect individuals? I am delighted to have with me Myrna Hecht. She's a longtime Islander, storyteller, poet, Vashon's Poet Laureate, and the founder and director of Stories of Arrival, Youth Voices Poetry Project, with refugees and immigrants. Welcome, Myrna.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here. My understanding is that you have completed 7 books of poetry from these young folks, from their voices, in their voices. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. They are all students at Foster High School in Tukwila, Washington. And Foster is said to be the most culturally and language diverse high school, or one of the top 5 in the United States. So the young people with whom I've worked all these years come from all over the world with asylum status, or they are immigrants.
And what was it that got you interested in creating this project of voicing them through poetry?
Well, I've always believed that poetry should serve the community, and by the community, I mean that in a large sense. Mm-hmm. So I've always felt that poetry should voice the underserved, the marginalized, the disenfranchised. And even before the present time that we're living in, with so much hate speech geared toward immigrants and refugees, I've always felt that youth, especially the underserved youth, have so much to teach us. And in truth, in all these years of working with these refugees and immigrants, these young people have really been teachers to me. I've not traveled a lot, but the world has come to me through this project.
Fascinating. So what, I'm sure you cannot summarize this in one soundbite, but what is it you have learned from these young people?
Most of all, I have learned the dignity of the cultures that they come from. They come from cultures that still value education. They come from cultures that have an ancient tradition of poetry. And I've learned what it means to live inside of a kind of honoring and dignity that they extend to teachers, to each other. They have served as a model for me of what the United Nations really should look like. And they've served as a model for me for the kinds of language and words and ideals that our own leaders should uphold but do not. And these young people bring that urgency for peace and for truth-telling and for struggle unlike any other group I have could ever possibly know.
That's pretty stunning.
Yes,
lucky
it is.
You. How many different countries are represented in your 7 books?
Great question. I counted them not too long ago. And over the last 7 years, in this project, we've worked with young people from at least 32 different countries.
Oh, my God.
That's astonishing. I know.
And these are primarily refugees?
Primarily refugees from countries we do think about and don't think about. Afghanistan, Iraq are in the news. Burma, which is the longest ongoing war spanning the middle of the 20th century until this moment, is really in the recent news because of Aung San Suu Kyi becoming the leader and then the disappointment in her because of the Rohingya crisis.
Yes, yes. And you've been working with Rohingya?
I do have some Rohingya students, and I also have other tribal students from Burma who are subject to unspeakable atrocities from the Burmese military.
Would you be willing to share some of those stories with us?
Yes. The young people from Burma, many of them write about escapes in the dark of night, running away from soldiers. A girl from this year's project wrote about her mother carrying her two-year-old brother up above her head as she and her mother and other siblings literally walk through excrement and mud and ooze, fleeing soldiers, frightened every minute that they would be caught and likely killed. True story. And she is a lovely young woman who writes beautiful poetry.
And she is now living in this country?
Yes.
Safely?
Yes.
So far?
Yes.
Is there a majority country among in this group?
That's a great question. The majority would be Burma. Most of the refugees from Burma prefer saying Burma rather than Myanmar.
Ah.
And the other majority, surprisingly, would be Nepal. Nepal has many refugee camps where it's complicated, but where the Bhutanese, Nepalese end up. Bhutan, which has a reputation for being a very peaceful country, in fact, has a fierce military that has kicked out a large Nepalese population.
Really?
Yes.
These are things we don't hear about in the news.
We don't hear about them because we, as the power monger of the world, don't need anything they have. Nepal doesn't have oil. It doesn't have uranium. It doesn't have things we're after.
Right.
And so it's quiet. But these Nepalese, Bhutanese young people who do have asylum status come from large refugee camps, experiences of tremendous food rationing, food scarcity. Many of them have not gone to school until they arrive in a new country.
Is there an age range that you work with?
I work with all high school individuals, but some of them are older because of not having gone to school.
Yeah.
So they could be anywhere from 14 to 19, even to 20.
That's mighty impressive. I know you want to read some excerpts for us from some of these young people's stories, and can you give us the backdrop for each one, or do you need to?
Well, I'm not going to say the name of the young man I'm going to read, because he is from Honduras, and let me just say that I expect he is not documented. And as I hope listeners know, very recently the Trump administration has taken away TPS, temporary protective status, for Nicaraguans, for Haitians, very recently for 250,000 people from El Salvador,
yes.
And we're very concerned that Honduras is next. Before I read this young man's poem from Honduras, I want to say that many of these young people from Central America have told me over and over that their experience of living in their countries is either being forced to join a gang or seeing people killed right in front of them. And they know if they are sent back, they will either be forced to join a gang or they will likely be killed or kill someone. So here is what this beautiful young man from Honduras writes, in part from a poem called Naming Myself. He writes, "He whose skin is the color of brown pride. He who misses his country because the morning is filled with soft clouds in white skies, with morning stars where the sky and the ocean are interchangeable. He who wants everyone to know that Honduras is more than gangs, that Honduras is more than perfect beaches." That's an excerpt from his poem. And I want to point out that, like most all of the young people in this project, this young man and the rest, most all of the young people have not written poetry before.
Are you translating from their language, or did they write these poems in English?
I encourage them to use their home language as much as possible, because home language is identity and culture and family. But I also remind them that poetry is this wonderful place where you can break rules. Mm-hmm. And so rather than have them worry about grammar and spelling and all the rest of it, I say, put your heart to the page. Give your story. Give it from your heart. Tell the truth. And they love that. And that's what they do.
How do you see this helping them manage their situations here in the United States?
They tell me, because we have them write a reflection after the project and speak to that, that one of the largest ways that this helps them is because they see themselves in each other's stories. Mm. And what that does is it breaks down boundaries between religions, between countries, between ideologies. I have Hindu young people, Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, tribal, and they form a community together of compassion and empathy for their struggles and their arduous journeys. And they hold each other up, believing in the dream of succeeding through education. Whether or not this country will give that to them, I don't know.
That's kind of an ominous statement. And as I listen to you speak about that, I'm wondering if this project then has helped those people to become part of a community that is within the United States, but also more understanding and accepting and of their situations. In other words, helping them, I don't know if it would be assimilate or at least feel somewhat more at home here. Does it work in that way?
To be honest, I think it used to. Again, we're 7 years in this project, and this year our theme was caring for the earth and each other.
Mm-hmm.
And our book is called Holding the Earth Together. And I never could have anticipated how timely this theme was, caring for the earth for each other. And I can feel this year, and I know I'm not projecting, attention and anxiety, a larger grief than usual, because it's inevitable that of all the young people who would be alert to the languaging that's going on in this country, it's targeting them, and they're aware of it. And I think that they are in a really precarious position of wanting to believe in their dreams, holding amazing hope for the world, and yet understanding the reality of a political climate that is targeting them, misnaming them, and really expounding an unjust and unfair hatred toward them, which breaks my heart, by the way.
I bet it does.
Yes, it does.
Of course, is very personal for you. These people are individuals whom you know, and I don't think, of course, all the rhetoric removes the individual.
Well, exactly.
And vilifies them.
Yes, and I think there's so many statistics. We know it's the largest refugee crisis since World War II, and we know that there's literally millions of children who are among those refugees. But it's those individual stories, this outpouring of humanity through poetry that humanizes what is so dehumanized in this larger narrative that's going on not only in our country, but in many other places around the world as well. And that's one reason I believe in this project and in poetry, because it gives us that human moment over and over. It allows us to grieve, allows us to sing our praise songs. It does what poetry's always done.
Yeah. Good, succinct, direct language. And I believe, you tell me if I'm right, we here in the U.S. hear the American side of the story of refugees being here. We very rarely hear their side of the story, what it was like before they got here and what they went through to get here. I'm presuming these poems tell some of that story.
Absolutely. That's why the project is called Stories of Arrival.
Mm-hmm.
And in all refugee stories, in all of our stories, when an event of trauma happens, then we have three stories. We have the before story, and many young people write about that. The peaceful farm, the grandmother bending down picking her tomatoes or peppers, the shared injera at the community meal, that would be the Horn of Africa. So there's the before story that the students write about. Then there's the during story. And the students write about that with bravery, courage, eloquence, the war, the landmines, the guns, the child soldiers, the grabbing the possessions and leaving home. And then the story always changes. So the before story, the trauma story, and then the change. Who am I now? Where is my family? Who have I left behind? I am learning English, but I'm the translator for my parents. They do not speak English. I am torn between my old cultural values that I want to uphold and this urgency to assimilate and be an American teenager. So the stories really are interwoven between those three narratives.
It sounds almost unbearable. I'm impressed with the fact that these young people are going strong. They're still trying to make their lives here work. And I'm struck by how many of them you think would go back home if it was safe?
Well, first of all, I love that you used the word unbearable. I just want to say that there's such resilience in these young people, and they know how to hold grief, unlike how I see our culture, which mm-hmm. doesn't seem to know how to grieve and hold the grief. And they also know how to hold hope and dreams. Most all of them would love to go back. Most all of them write about becoming nurses and doctors and social workers in order to go back and bring their country to wholeness and to peace. The theme of peace in this project all 7 years is extraordinary. And that's what keeps me hopeful because these young people hold on to that dream of peace.
So if they could go back to their home countries, they could
absolutely
create peace.
Absolutely.
If they could get back there. We don't hear that here. We don't hear about how destructive all these wars are. We don't get the personal view. And I'm wondering how fragile these young people's refugee status is. How likely is it they will be sent back, whether it's safe or not?
That's a great question. For the young people who are from some of the countries under the proposed travel ban, which is back and forth in the courts, and now we see it, now we don't. An example is Somalia. There are quite a few students, and always have been in the project, from Somalia. The conditions there are horrific. The war is brutal. All of the young people from Somalia write about the blood in the streets. They've seen people die. Under the travel ban, right now I have two beautiful young women in the project whose mother is in Somalia. They understand and they write about it with such pathos that they may never see their mother again because she will not be allowed to come here to see them. And if they go back, it's too dangerous and she doesn't want them to come back. So they live in this unspeakable longing for each other. And these two young women write about it quite a bit, about their mother and her tears and her anguish.
Who do they live with here?
They have some extended family. There's a large Horn of Africa community in the south part of Seattle, flowing into Burien, Tukwila. And many of them came here before the Trump administration, and they tend to live with foster families or with extended family.
This may be a really stupid question, but it's my job to ask those stupid questions in case there are listeners out there who don't know the answer. And I'm wondering if you could just mention the difference between refugee versus immigrant status.
Absolutely. So when you arrive in this country with a refugee status, you're given asylum. And it is a long and arduous pathway to get your green card and then by extension to become a citizen. But you have a chance because you have asylum, you have protected status. And that was what the temporary protected status was. It was like having asylum and giving you a pathway to citizenship, even though you weren't yet a citizen. Mm-hmm. When you come as an immigrant, you have to go through very complicated channels, even to come here and be in a position to receive your green card, but you are not protected. You do not have asylum. You do not have protected status. And let me add that those with asylum, it's stated, documented, it's a UN document. If you have asylum, it's understood that if you go back to your country, you will very likely be tortured, lose your life, that it is dangerous. Many immigrants who are in this country have the exact same situation. If they go back to their countries, they may be tortured, they may lose their life, they may starve, they may go back into untenable conditions. And that's not the story that's being told right now, to say the least. And I think it's really important for people to understand that we are a nation of immigrants and refugees, mm-hmm. and we are departing from those core values and closing our doors. I'm not saying we are, Susan. but it is something that's occurring
our government
in this country.
Is doing
absolutely.
It, yes. You're listening to Real Talk. It's 1220, and we're on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP Vashon Island, Washington. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm talking with Myrna Hecht, who is Vashon's Poet Laureate and the founder director of Stories of Arrival, Youth Voices Poetry Project with Refugees and Immigrants. And she's been working with students in Tukwila. Yes, we are closing our doors to refugees and immigrants. A nation that was built on those people's backs in many cases. I know that you have many stories to tell, and I'd like for our listeners to hear some of those poems, some more of those poems.
I would love to read some of those poems. I'm going to read a poem by a young man from Somalia, and it shows how much these young people are ambassadors. I'll let the poem speak for itself. He uses the ocean as a metaphor for war and peace. It's called Somalia and Ocean. Somalia is an ocean. Undisturbed, it is beautiful, clear, blue, peaceful. Disturbed and disrupted, it is dark, bloody, dangerous. The ocean is calling us. The tides are bringing peace, but we can't hear. Because of the war, we change the water into blood, and the beautiful waves that have always been there have gone to jail for a long time now. The ocean is crying because we let her down. We smashed her to the ground and denied her any chance for peace. As if we don't need the ocean, but we long for her to see the reflection of our beauty in her. Somalia, it is time to open our eyes and see how the ocean looks today. Somalia, it is time to free the ocean. It is time for the ocean to rise like the flag that stands for peace. Let the ocean tides bring us peace. Somalia, it is time to welcome the ocean and open our hearts. Let us come together, be undisturbed in peace. Let us come together and let the water be clear once more, and we shall not let our blood touch the water again.
That's incredibly moving. What can you tell us about the politics behind some of these horrific stories? Somalia, for instance.
Well, that would be a whole other interview. As you know, there's money to be made through wars. And there's money to be made especially through the arms trade. So it's so complicated, but it appears, and I have read a tremendous amount, so I'm going by research here, and fact, not alt fact, it appears that some of the massive weapons trade in which the U.S. is involved ends up in the hands of the very people that we name as our enemies. And so the complex web of profit to be made, sex trafficking, human trafficking, smugglers, wars that we perpetuate, the idea of unending war that defines, unfortunately, the 20th into the 21st century has resulted in this largest refugee crisis that we've ever seen. Combine that with climate change and scarcity of food and water, and we have this huge problem. The young people with whom I work, and many of the scholars, philosophers, dreamers that I most respect, believe there are solutions to these problems, and I have to believe there are. But I don't think we're going about this complex situation in the right way. And I want to say, if I have time, that the young people in the project this year, because of caring for the earth and each other, speak to that very situation. And I could read a couple poems that address that if you would like.
I would like that, but when you talk about the profiteering through arms, that seems to be the core. Are people coming up with solutions to attack that very core issue. Like, how are we going to stop the arms trade?
Well, here's the thing. I teach a class at the University of Washington called Art in Time of War. And I end the class by having all the students, these are upperclassmen, juniors and seniors, find agencies working for the good for some of these main problems in the world. And there are many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, peace groups, think tanks who really are working to solve these problems.
Really?
Absolutely.
That's good
and
news.
That's a major research project that I have my students involved in, and it's been a major payoff for me because, again, that's a place where I have a lot of hope. Because for all of the negativity and the hate speech and the racism, there is a tremendous amount of on-the-ground, active, way beyond words, actions, resistance, and thinking about how to solve these problems. I think we're in a race, and I don't know how it's going to end, but there are definitely fine, thoughtful people working on these core problems, and they're huge problems.
Yes, they are huge, and as you say, complicated problems. I want to hear some more of those poems that you have.
I would love to read a poem by a young man from Burma. He's tribal. He's Karen. The Karen people have been the recipients of genocide, basically, from the Burmese military. But that's not what he's writing about here. He's writing a poem for the earth. It's called "The Land is Crying." The land is crying. Do you hear that? He's crying. The land is crying. Without him, our animals and our food, we wouldn't be able to live. His sister is polluted. His brother is also polluted. We humans are selfish. We think for ourselves and not about what's around us. Our nuclear waste is killing him. Our conflicts are also killing him with our wars. Do you still hear him? Or are you just blind and deaf? Because we are also killing ourselves. But let us be human and love our surroundings. So many of the poems in the book are naming our disasters of war. They're naming our militarism. And these young people are asking us to stop it and bring about protection for the earth, care for the earth and each other, and protection of the environment. Of the 42 students in this year, I'm happy to say there are no climate change deniers. And these young people are all aboard for speaking out for the earth. And if I have time, I could read one more poem.
I was curious also about the poems you mentioned from the two young women who are from Somalia that were so personal about missing their loved ones. Do you have that with you?
I do, but I would have to find it in the book.
Okay, that's all right.
Yeah, I can tell you that they each write about their mother's tears, the anguish in their mother's face, and the depths of their missing her. They're twins. They're not twins. One of them is about a year and a half older than the other.
That's enough. Who are you going to read?
I am going to read a poem by a Nepalese refugee, a young woman called Earth. Again, to let the listeners know the deep thoughtfulness of these young people and their passion that we get it right and learn to protect the earth and each other. It's called Earth. Earth, I want to honor you. With you, I have a home, a place of sunlight. We are all here on Earth to help each other. You show me respect to older people. You show me the ways I need to learn. I honor you and your place in people's hearts. Earth, I want to apologize to you. We take you for granted. We poison your water. We burn too much gas and pollute your air. We create wars and prejudice. I am sorry we have forgotten where we come from, who our mother truly is. Earth, I want to tell you, we are proud to live here. We belong to the earth. We must remember to respect you.
And we unfortunately have to respect time. We're out of it.
thank you.
Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Real Talk with myself, Susan McCabe, and my wonderful guest, Myrna Hecht, creator of the project Stories of Arrival. Youth Voices Poetry from Refugees and Immigrants. Next week, Terry Hershey is going to tell us how to rest, renew, and live. We can do this thanks to Windermere Vashon Real Estate for their support, making all our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Join me every Tuesday at noon. It's sure to be real.